Corbin Middlemass here. What's going on with the cricket? Well, that's what the ABC Cricket Podcast is for, with me and my sparring partner, Ed Cowan. Who's been selected?
You got another 100 during the week.
Who's been rejected?
So obviously, if he's not fit enough.
And who has the best grade cricket salad roll?
What was the key? The quality of the cheese or the bun?
Bun was always fresh, or the salad inside nice and soft.
Search for the ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Besha Rodel has spent her career doing a job most people would kill for. She's a critic who's traveled the world, eating at some of the most exclusive restaurants, as well as your suburban local gems, in order to tell us whether they're worth visiting. But Besha's a most unlikely candidate for a restaurant critic, not only because critics' wages meant she sometimes couldn't afford groceries at the same time she was dining out. In fact, she started this job while on food assistance stamps in North Carolina and considers her true home in hospitality as being on staff, flirting with the ratbag line cooks. Hi, Besha.
Hi.
So, Besha, tell me about the most magical dish that you've eaten lately.
I was very lucky recently to be able to review Iaga, which is a new restaurant in Melbourne, in Fitzroy Gardens. And it's one of those restaurants that really the sum of its parts is what makes it so incredible. So the food is beautiful, but it also is kind of the setting with the food, with the kind of feel of the place. So you're in this gorgeous room in Fitzroy Gardens, and it really feels like the gardens are coming into the room. The walls are all glass. And, you know, Fitzroy Gardens are my favorite of all of the Melbourne formal Victorian gardens. They're just so gorgeous and just this kind of magical, almost fairyland of a place. And so I'll tell you about a dish that is caviar-based, huge spoonful of really beautiful caviar on top of this layered combination of coconut cream and macadamia oil. And so it's just this kind of creamy, slick, but then with this kind of very soft salinity of the caviar with that little pop of caviar in your mouth. And he serves it, you know, with this beautiful mother-of-pearl spoon. And the whole thing is just very otherworldly. It, you know, it kind of reminds me of those early 19th, 20th century illustrations of like fairies in Australia, you know, like the Australian landscape as seen through the lens of magic almost. So incredibly transportive and just really delicious.
That sounds really magical. Your description is transporting me there. But what about restaurants? You know, you've been in probably countless restaurants. What gets you excited when you step inside?
I have never gotten bored of that kind of tinkle of excitement when you walk into a restaurant and it has all of that energy. You can hear people talking and laughing. There is the sound of clinking glasses. You can maybe hear the undertone of the kitchen in the background of sizzle and people calling orders. A restaurant in full swing has a kind of energy that I think is very difficult to replicate anywhere else.
Do you have a formula for doing your reviews?
I do. It's changed a little now that I'm in Australia. I came to Australia to work for the New York Times Bureau here in 2017. And even prior to working for the New York Times, I really went by their formula that was basically invented by Craig Claiborne in the 1970s, which is you go as anonymously as possible. You book under a false name. You pay with a credit card that has a different name on it. And you visit at least three times. Australian journalism has a fairly different standard, I would say. There's a lot of one-visit reviews happening here. I'm still not really comfortable with that, so I tend to go twice now. I try to bring very different people. I'm married to a chef. He often comes with me for one visit because he's very useful if I have questions about cooking or whatever. But then I bring friends who maybe don't know anything about food to see how they feel about it. I do a huge amount of research. I pester the chefs after I've visited with a million questions about how they prepared things. But the fun part of it for me, too, isn't just the eating. It's saying, okay, what's the cultural context of this dish? What's the history? What can I find out? I reviewed an Italian restaurant in Melbourne a couple weeks ago that is known for its pasta with Moreton Bay bug, and they've been open for 30 years. And I did this deep dive with the librarian at the Age to see if they were the first people to do that dish, because it's such a standard of Australian cooking now. And I love that. That part of it that's research-based is really exciting for me. But the basic thing of it is you go at least a couple times on different nights of the week. You want to go sometime when they're really busy, sometime when they're not. And you eat as much of the menu as you can. If something's really uneven one night, you try to see if it's better a different night. And then you do a bunch of research and spend a lot of time thinking about it, and then you sit down to write.
And for most of your career, you were an anonymous critic.
Yes.
Were you a good candidate for anonymity?
I mean, the funny thing is people say, like, why did you choose anonymity? And the truth of it is I started at a time when all of us were anonymous. Like, my first job in criticism was 2006, and it was just after the advent of Facebook, and it was when Facebook was still very college kid oriented. Mm-hmm. And so I just wasn't on Facebook yet. And so anybody at that point would have been a good candidate for anonymity if they weren't already literally famous, yeah. You know? It was also just such a part of the lore of restaurant criticism at that point. Ruth Reichel at the New York Times was really known for her disguises and taking it very seriously. And it was part of the fun for me of thinking about a job in that realm. But in some ways, I was a great candidate for it because I was young, I was poor, I didn't look like somebody who belonged in these restaurants. And it was really, you know, it's actually one of the hardest things for me about aging is that I now, no matter what I wear, pretty much look like I belong in a restaurant. I'm a middle-aged white lady. Like, there's not anything I could do to, like, really make myself look like it was my one meal out of the year.
You've grown into it.
Yeah, exactly, which is annoying because but, of course, now I've given up the anonymity as pretty much every critic on earth has done just because of the age that we're in. It's impossible. And I miss it a lot, but it had to be done.
Yeah. So. Well, let's go back to the beginning, Besha, because you were born when your family lived on a place called Narnia.
Yes.
I'm not making that up. That's fact. What do you remember from that place?
Oh, Narnia was so magical. It was in East Gippsland, far East Gippsland, a town called Club Terrace that is not really even a town anymore. At the time, it had 3 sawmills. Now it doesn't. And it is temperate rainforest, one of the only temperate rainforests in the world, which just means that it's incredibly lush, incredibly dense, pretty spooky landscape, a bit haunted. A lot of Scots ended up colonizing there because it felt a little bit like Scotland, I think, in part. It's so green. And it was just a really magical place to be a little kid. I kind of had free rein. I ran around naked and chased the cows and collected lizards. And, it was kind of this ramshackle house, and a big barn and an orchard. It's kind of, you know, if you've seen Anne of Green Gables, the original 80s one, it kind of felt like that a bit, but an Australian version. So it was just a really magical place to be a small child.
You were a little girl running around this magical place, and actually you have quite a magical name. Besha, do you mind just saying your full name?
Sure. It's Beshalaba River Puffin Rodell.
What is the story behind this incredible name?
Beshalaba is, my father made it up. He was many things, but he was primarily in the 70s a religious scholar. And so it is a bit of an amalgamation of Elishaba and Bathsheba, which are both biblical names. But he also you know, he named the farm that we were on Narnia. He was a Tolkien fan. He obviously had this kind of mystical sense of place. And so he made up Bashalaba. And then River, my mother wanted to name me River because there was a river that ran through the farm. She spent most of her pregnancy kind of in that river. Puffin, my father had changed his last name to Puffin in the 70s. And in Australia, in Victoria, at that time, you had to have your father's last name. My parents weren't married. And so I was born Bashalaba Puffin. He eventually changed his name back to his original last name. So I have this last name on my birth certificate that doesn't relate to either of my parents, really. But my parents had agreed that any girls they would have my mother's last name, and any boys would have his last name. So they eventually legally changed my name to Rodell, which is my mother's last name. So then I ended up with this crazy long name with all these parts.
Well, it's got a great story to it. Your parents, they were clearly very free-thinking, creative folk. What were they like together?
I barely remember them together, honestly. And what I do remember of them together was mostly bad. They broke up when I was seven. And so I have very little memory of them together in a loving sense, partly also because when we were on the farm, a lot of that time my father was in Germany doing research. So I don't have a whole lot of recollection of him on the farm, and what I do isn't really related to my mother. So a lot of what I remember of them is them fighting, honestly, and him being really sad. And, you know, my mother is 14 years younger than my father, and she was a journalist in Melbourne. We moved to Melbourne when I was five, and she was, you know, still in her 30s. She was very beautiful. She was very smart. And so she just was having a blast in the early 80s in Melbourne journalism. And he was kind of this fuddy-duddy professor type who was much older. And so I remember them in huge contrast.
What do you remember about the house that you moved to in Melbourne, the share house in Brunswick?
It was this massive, on Park Street in Brunswick, across from the park there, one of these massive terrace houses, white with black trim. It had been a convent. I guess it wasn't built as a convent, but there was a bunch of nuns living there before we moved in. And it had, I want to say, you know, six or seven bedrooms and this massive staircase and this grand room upstairs. The living room upstairs had this, you know, bright red carpet. So it was this funny thing because it was quite a grand, beautiful house with just all these, again, rat bags living there, bunch of hippies, couple single moms with their kids. There was a bikey guy named Glenn who lived downstairs. It was a really fun place in a lot of ways. I think if it wasn't kind of so tied to the trauma of my parents breaking up, I would remember it very fondly.
There was another little girl there. Her name was Sarah. She lived in that old house with her mom. How did you two get along?
We got along great. I mean, she was very bossy, and I kind of let her be, I think. But we just became this kind of gang of two. Our parents were pretty hands-off, you know, kind of we were kind of latchkey kid types. And so we almost built this whole little world of our own in that house together.
Where did her father take the two of you for her birthday dinner?
So when she turned 10, I believe, he took us to Stephanie's, which at the time it was in Hawthorne, in this mansion in Hawthorne, by far the kind of fanciest restaurant in Melbourne. In retrospect, I understand that it was, one of the most important restaurants in Australian kind of culinary history right now. I know that, but at the time, it was just the first fancy restaurant I had ever been to. And I was just so blown away by it. I just, you know, my parents didn't have much money. We didn't eat out really at all. My parents were very good cooks, but so food was important to me, but I had never seen it in the context of a restaurant like that, certainly. And I just fell in love immediately with that experience.
What do you remember about that night?
Really, the biggest thing I remember is the room and the feel of the place. I remember the view across the table. I remember these amazing brocade kind of curtains. I remember the waiters. I don't really remember the food. It wasn't really about the food for me. It was about, I mean, I'm sure it was. I'm sure the food was delicious, and I'm sure that I was, you know, excited by that. But the main thing for me was just that you could elevate something as kind of quotidian as dinner to this level of opulence that's just ridiculous. And I think that I even at that point understood that it was ridiculous, but the ridiculousness was part of the appeal to me. I think that that's one of the things, arguments I get in with people who are kind of anti-fine dining or anti-restaurants, where they're just like, why would you spend that kind of money on dinner? It's so stupid. And I'm like, that's part of what's awesome about it, is that it's so stupid. Like, I just loved that it was that kind of, you could just on any given day, no matter who you were, if you had that money in your pocket, you could go in and pretend to be a princess, basically. And, you know, being the age that I was and the gender that I was, I think I was pretty obsessed with that idea of, you know, of being a princess, of being just pampered in that way.
After your experience at that luxurious, opulent restaurant, what role did food then have in your imagination?
I was pretty obsessed with restaurants from then on, something that my parents really didn't understand. And I pestered them to take me to restaurants from then on. And they tried their best. And, you know, I really did. We went to the Waiters Club. We went to places that were kind of, you know, neighborhood Italian places. But that wasn't, and I loved those places too, and I still love those places, and that was better than nothing. But I just really longed for that very fancy restaurant experience, I think. The role of food overall had always been important to me, and I was cooking from a really young age, and both of my parents were very good cooks, so that continued. But I just, from then on, I think, had this idea in my head that the apex of luxury was this idea of the fancy restaurant.
And when you're 14, your family made a big change. By this stage, you had a stepdad, you had two more younger siblings. Where did you all go?
So my mother is American, and she basically decided to return to the U.S. at that point. She was a journalist. I think she felt fairly hemmed in by Australian journalism. You know, it's, I think, still pretty male-dominated now. You can imagine what it was like in the 80s. And she felt very relegated to kind of the writing about, you know, home stuff or whatever. She worked for some pretty serious newspapers and did some pretty serious work. But it's very hard if you've been in America to break out of the idea that America is more important than the rest of the world. I think that that's especially true in journalism. And she wanted to work for the New York Times or something as, you know, as important. I think she was also really struggling in her marriage to my stepfather at that point, and she saw it as a way to not escape because he came with us, but to get to a place where she had some allies. So we went to live with her brother, my uncle, in Denver, Colorado, and she started looking for work, and she eventually ended up getting a job at the Hartford Courant in Connecticut, and so we moved to Connecticut.
How did you take to life in America?
Really badly. I didn't want to move. I left my father and my grandmother, who I was very close to, in Melbourne, and all my friends. You know, that's the point in life when you kind of build your identity around friendships. And then my mother and stepfather broke up, and, you know, he and I were not getting along well at all at that point either, but just kind of that second split within the span of a few years really did a number on me, as did a lot of things. Who knows, you know? But I just basically became a delinquent. I was also, I should say, like, I was going to school in Hartford, Connecticut, at this giant public high school. I was one of like three white kids in 2,200 kids school. So, you know, that was its own its own situation where I to survive a bit, I think, and also just because I wanted to, the only thing to do was really just be a reprobate.
What kind of reprobate were you?
I just skipped class all the time and did a lot of drugs and sat in the park.
Eventually, you found yourself in North Carolina and you got a hospitality job at a restaurant called Goldie's. What was that place like?
It was very hip. It was very modern. It had this, the chef there was doing kind of modern Southern American food. He was incredibly talented. It was dark. It was not that big, pretty, you know, pretty small dining room with kind of black walls and these giant bright paintings on the wall. All of the staff were black. Everyone was beautiful. Everyone was cool. It just was one of these places that felt so slick and the food was so good.
I mean, as you say that, it's like a little pocket of Melbourne in North Carolina.
100%. And I probably didn't know that at the time, but definitely.
That was the vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there a standout item on the menu there?
Oh, there were a few. There was a foie gras BLT that was just this ridiculous, you know, bacon, lettuce, tomato, and then this seared piece of foie gras that was just stupid and delicious. Again, made me so happy how stupid that was.
And what about the people? What made you feel like, oh, I found my people?
They were all really smart and really funny. And I loved that all of these, you know, this collection of young, beautiful weirdos had kind of were doing hospitality. Because it was North Carolina, it probably wasn't the cliche of LA or New York where everyone was trying to be an actor or a writer. Most of them, I was in Chapel Hill, so which is very well known for its music scene, its indie rock music scene, and so a lot of them were in bands. But it was just such a sense of camaraderie, and the banter was just so good, and it just. But they also, these were people who, because of the work, had to care deeply about food and wine, and I cared so much about food and wine, and when you are in your early 20s and kind of a degenerate, most people don't care about food and wine, you know? So, and I think that that's changed. I think that these days it's a pretty common thing for young people to be interested in, but this was late 90s, early 2000s, and it just wasn't, you know? And so to find this group of people who weren't just waiting tables only to pay rent, but to have fun and to care about something and to learn about something, that was really exciting.
And your Harvard-educated, hard-charging journalist mom, how did she see a future for you in this world?
She did not. And she, you know, had a couple of very stern conversations with me about how she thought I was throwing away my life and how I was wasting my time and I was too smart to be waiting tables. And, you know, in some ways she was probably right. At that point, though, I didn't have any university education. I had barely graduated high school. I had not been able to get any financial aid for school because my dad made a fair amount of money in Australia but wasn't supporting me at all. So, you know, I found that line of thinking fairly frustrating because I feel like I was doing the best that I could at that time. And I was also really passionate about what I was doing, but she just didn't see what what future food could hold for me. She didn't want me to be a lifelong waitress. She wouldn't have been happy if I became a restaurant owner or, you know, any of those things. So it was a bit of a piece of contention between us.
Besha, you were working at Goldie's in North Carolina, and then you met a certain cook who also worked there. Tell me about Ryan.
Ryan was the sauté cook. It was a small kitchen, three people on the line and an expediter. And they were just, you know, the kind of band of married pirates, as the cliche goes, but it was very true of them. They were all, you know, so ridiculous, very inappropriate, really funny. And I gravitated to that kitchen culture very quickly. Ryan was really skinny at the time. He, you know, this blonde, shaggy head guy, and the, you know, people would tell me he had been in this really good band that everybody loved that had broken up, but he used to be kind of this touring musician. He was just, he was really sweet and funny and a little bit weird. And we just became really good friends pretty quickly.
How would you spend time together at first?
Just after work, we would go to the bar around the corner. They had $1.50 Miller High Lifes, champagne, a beer. So we would smoke cigarettes and drink beer. And then kind of slowly, you know, people would go home and we would just continue to hang out. We used to, it was summertime, we would walk around Chapel Hill, walk around the train tracks and just talk until the sun came up. You know, I was actually living with a boyfriend at the time. I was in a relationship, but it was going pretty poorly. And he left for the summer to go do a music program in Boston. And so I was, you know, a bit at loose ends and pretty aware that that relationship was at its end. But, you know, it did really start fairly innocently with me and Ryan. We just were really good friends for a long time.
What did Ryan tell you about his past?
Not much at first. You know, he talked about the music a little bit, but eventually it came to be obvious that he always had somewhere to be early in the morning. So it kind of became a problem, this walking around till the sun came up. And he would start to say, I really need to go home and get some sleep, which I didn't really understand because we didn't have to be at work until one in the afternoon, or he didn't. But it turned out that he was needing to drive to Raleigh, which was about 40 minutes away, every morning to go to a methadone clinic. And so kind of slowly he told me about how he had been living in Greensboro. He went to college in Greensboro and had, you know, developed a fairly significant heroin addiction that he was in the process of weaning himself off of.
How was he when he'd had his dose of methadone? Did you notice a change in him?
I didn't notice a change in him, but I definitely noticed a change if he didn't get it or if he got it late. He would get kind of antsy and itchy and sweaty and uncomfortable. It was pretty unusual. He was pretty consistent with it, but I do think I had memories of that.
How did you help him wean himself off the methadone?
I didn't. He did that completely on his own. He was on methadone for probably the first year that we knew each other, and I moved to New York in that time frame to go to college. And we decided that we wanted to stay together after I was gone. Like, the idea was I was leaving, and so it couldn't be a long-term relationship. But then once I left, it became obvious to both of us that we wanted to continue that relationship. And that period of time when I was in New York and he was in North Carolina is the main period of time that he was coming off of methadone. I really think that both of us were cognizant of the idea that it was pretty dangerous for somebody in that state of vulnerability to do something with the help of somebody else or to do something for somebody else. So there was never a sense that he was doing it for me or that I was helping him to do it. I think that it was much more that he could see this life with me in New York. And it was very difficult at that point in time, I think it probably still is, to transfer from one methadone program to another in another state. So he knew that if he wanted that life with me, he needed to get off of it, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do.
It sounds so hard, that process. How hard was it for him in that final push? What did you see him grappling with?
It's something that I've never dealt with, a physical addiction of that kind. But I think about it a lot now. If I'm ever sick, like if you have the flu, if you're just like in the worst part of the flu, when you just feel like you want your skin to come off, kind of, you would take anything to make that feeling stop almost, you know? And so having to push through that when you know that there is a solution is just, it's Herculean. It's crazy. And to do it day after day, I mean, obviously you wean down slowly. They give you other kind of drugs to help here and there. But he was determined. He was very determined, and he didn't complain a lot about it. And I never really doubted that he was going to do it. And I'm not sure why, but, you know, that was more than 25 years ago now. And you know, he has been clean since. So
that's huge. That's amazing.
It's amazing.
You and Ryan eventually did make the big move to New York together. And what was your schedule like, you know, in that big city?
It was wild. I was going to school full time. I was working nights at a restaurant in Brooklyn, and I had various internships here and there. I was also working for some literary agencies. I was usually up in the morning doing some kind of internship or some kind of office job, going to classes, and then waiting tables at night. I just never had a day off. Ryan also was the sous chef at Montrachet, which was a very fancy French restaurant in Soho. And he was working 6 days a week with one double on Fridays. They did lunch and dinner on Fridays. So, you know, he was working 80 hours a week or something. He had Sundays off and he just slept on Sundays. But that was fine because I was usually working on Sundays. So, you know, occasionally we would have Sundays off together, but it was pretty wild.
Not long after you and Ryan arrived in New York, you got inundated with calls from home. Your phone wouldn't stop ringing. Who was it?
So the first call that came in was from the ex-boyfriend who I had been with for a number of years. And, you know, we were close still in some ways, but he knew that I was living with Ryan and, you know, wasn't thrilled about that. And so he you know, we weren't really communicating much at that point. So it was weird. It was kind of this thing where I was asleep. I was fast asleep. It was 9 something in the morning. And I heard the answering machine go off and with him saying, please call me and let me know that you're okay. And I kind of ignored that. And I was in this kind of dream state. And then a couple of minutes later, the phone rang again. And it was my father in Australia. And he never called. You know, we spoke on birthdays, Christmas, he just wasn't a big phone talker. So that really woke me up because I just was not used to hearing from him. And he also was saying, please let me know that you're okay.
And then you went outside. What did you see?
So we were living in Fort Greene at the time. We were about a half block from Fort Greene Park. And Fort Greene Park has this peak at the top of it that there were all these people gathered there. And at that point, the first tower had come down. I think the second plane had gone in, but the second tower had not come down. So we were standing in this group of people in this part of Brooklyn that has a direct line of sight to Lower Manhattan, and we watched the second tower come down from that park.
I'm getting chills just hearing you talk about that. What was going through your mind as you saw one of the towers collapse in front of you?
I remember thinking, everything has changed. It was just one of those moments when you see history happen and you realize that there's a certain innocence loss, you know, that nothing's going to be the same. There was also some, as happens with these things, there was some human almost comedy to it. We were standing there and some guy's phone went off and he picked it up and he said, you know, New Jersey, tell that towers just fell down. I'm not going anywhere. And like people kind of laughed because it was just like, what are you talking about? The world is not going to go on.
But it's still so New York.
Yeah, exactly.
So there?
Yeah, exactly. Where are, what, you know? So, I mean, and that was the thing about New York in those days right after it. There was such a shared sense of grief and it felt very connected. It felt it was the one and only time almost that I feel like I felt incredibly connected in that town to everybody around me, no matter who they were.
What happened after that? I mean, were you able to go to work? Were people even going to restaurants after that horrific disaster?
We didn't open the restaurant for a couple of days that I was working at. I was working in Brooklyn. And then we reopened on the Friday night.
Tell me about the first table you served that night.
So we had this really beautiful little outdoor courtyard in the back of the restaurant. And we had a staff meal before that we all sat down together. It was very heartfelt. And I think I had it in my head that like it would help me in some ways to be serving people, to be nourishing people. And the first table that we got that I got was these two kind of tech bros or Wall Street types. I don't know who they were. And one of them ordered a Belgian beer, and I served it to them in a stemmed glass, which is appropriate for a Belgian beer. But this guy thought that it wasn't the right glass for a beer. He wanted a beer glass, and he kind of yelled at me about it. And there was still white stuff coming out of the sky. Like there was, I just couldn't stop thinking about, there was probably still people alive under the rubble. You know, it was just the wildness of somebody caring about the glass that their beer was in. I just went into the walk-in and cried. And it was the first time I think I'd been in such shock that I just had been kind of a zombie for the first few days. But that act of, it's not even cruelty, it's just kind of anti-humanity to be caring about your glassware when this thing was happening. Yeah, it was wild.
But your time in New York was not to last very long because you and Ryan started a family and ended up moving back to North Carolina. How did you find new motherhood?
It was both just exquisite and beautiful and also the hardest time in my life, probably. I loved being a mother in the sense of the physical relationship with my son was just something I had never experienced before. He was so delightful and beautiful, and we had such an amazing connection, as you do. So that part of it was really lovely. The rest of it was very isolating. I hadn't meant to get pregnant. It was not planned. I was quite young, especially amongst my friends. Nobody else was having kids at that point in time. I was 26 when I got pregnant. So, and we were living in this kind of four-room house off the side of a highway in North Carolina between two towns. My sister came to live with me, Grace. She was, I think, 15 at the time. Ryan was working. He was making $32,000, $33,000 a year supporting four of us in this teeny house. So we were incredibly poor.
How are you getting by?
We qualified for WIC, which is a kind of subsidy of, it's a kind of food stamp, basically, that is for women and children. And I was trying for the first time to really pursue some kind of journalism. I had been writing some restaurant reviews on forums in New York when I was there. One of the editors of a small paper in North Carolina had seen one of those and liked them. So I did start making a little bit of money doing some writing at that point.
What could you buy with these food assistance stamps?
Not much. I mean, unlike food stamps, you can buy anything with. Regular food stamps, you can buy anything with that's edible. WIC is very specific, and I think it's because the idea is that it's for children and pregnant mothers. So you can buy milk, cheese, bread, your kind of standard things. But if you're in a supermarket in America and you look at the price tag, it says WIC next to the things that you can use WIC for. So it was always this negotiation. It was one of these kind of humiliating things where you would get up to the cash register and they would be checking to make sure that you had the right things, and they would send you back if they thought that you didn't. It was a bit humiliating, but I was grateful for it nonetheless.
You got your first job as a full-fledged restaurant critic in Atlanta. And then you moved on to LA Weekly in Los Angeles. And how did you find that fresh food scene in LA, the fruit and veggies?
Oh, it was amazing. It was mind-blowing. I mean, look, the South has better tomatoes than anywhere in the world. So there are certain things from the South that really I missed immediately. But the avocados, the nuts, I just, when I went out to LA for my interview, I ended up sitting at the bar at Mazza, which is a famous pizzeria in run by Nancy Silverton, and having a salad that had these walnuts in it that were just like the walnuttiest walnuts I'd ever tasted. They were like a revelation, you know?
But one by one, members of your family found themselves moving home to Australia. And then, you know, it's your turn. You started writing for the New York Times at their Australian Bureau. What kind of places were you reviewing then?
It was really hard. I was traveling constantly. My son was a teenager. He probably really needed me at that time. I was always gone. But I was also flying to Kakadu to eat at a Thai restaurant in the middle of this crazy town with nothing. I was able to go to Margaret River. I was able to, you know, fly all over the country and just find these really fascinating stories, mostly of pockets of immigrant culture that hasn't been well enough explored, I think, in Australian food writing. So in that sense, it was just really gratifying. And then Ukraine happened, COVID happened, the Middle East happened, and the money had to go elsewhere. So RIP, the Australian Bureau of the New York Times.
You finally made it back home to Australia after all these decades in the States. What made you feel like, I'm home, I'm here?
I mean, I have to say that I had built Melbourne up in my head in this way that was really like this lost love, this like, you know, yearning. I didn't want to leave Melbourne. I always resented that my mother took me away from Melbourne. And so even when I would visit in the intervening, I think it was 24 years, I always just felt like this crazy, I felt like I was in a dream every time I was here. I just felt like I was walking around in this dream of a place. I just always loved it. It always felt like home. You know, walking around streets where I had history, walking past that share house, walking past a building on Brunswick Road that like my grandfather's cereal factory had been in. I had history here. I had never had history anywhere else in that way, you know. I saw connections to my childhood self that just felt really profound, that the smell of kind of rain and eucalypt, that kind of thing that is just, I think, people take for granted if they've never been an immigrant or an expat, kind of that feeling that you belong somewhere is just really powerful. And it immediately felt right to me, and it immediately felt really, really embracing. I was worried because so much of my personality in America had been about me being Australian and me being from Melbourne. People thought I was weird because I had a clothesline, you know, like it's just stuff like that. And I was like, oh my God, am I going to still be an interesting person? Or is all of my interestingness just that I'm from Melbourne? You know, I just am a normal Melbourne person. It's been fine.
But, you know, as you say for the New York Times, you're crisscrossing Australia, a vast continent, reviewing in Kakadu, Margaret River. Did your home life have the same jet-setting quality?
No, and my home life was really probably, well, it was difficult. My son and my husband struggled hugely with that transition. The irony is that I did the exact same thing to my kid as was done to me at the exact same age, and he dealt with it just as poorly as I did. He didn't act out in the same way. He just got smaller, and it's something that I think will affect him for the rest of his life, as my move at that age has affected me for the rest of my life. I thought it would be different for him because we were not moving from Melbourne to Hartford, Connecticut, which is not the best place in the world. We were moving from LA to Melbourne, which is an amazing place. All of his aunts and uncles were already here. He would have a community, but you really can't project onto your own kids your own experience. It's a trap. The worst thing that ever happened to you is still the worst thing that ever happened to you, no matter who you are, you know? So the home life part of it was really hard.
That sounds like a massive adjustment. But I'm also curious about how your household was getting by financially at that time.
The New York Times was paying me not very much. And so we were pretty poor again. It was a little touch and go there. And it just, it was demoralizing to be back there at that point in my career. I mean, I was 20 years into this career. I was very well known in the U.S. And to again be like, well, we can't afford groceries, but sure, let's go out to dinner. I can expense that. You know, it's just such a weird thing. You know, it took us probably, I want to say, 18 months to get back on our feet financially. And again, that's just a pretty demoralizing thing to be happening 20 years into your career when you're in your mid-40s and have a teenage child.
The path that you've walked around this globe is quite something. And, you know, you haven't been alone. Like, you've had your family, your husband, Ryan, he's supported you. He's moved so many times together with you. What does he think about what you've been able to achieve together?
He's exceedingly proud of me, but I would be lying if I said there isn't I wouldn't call it resentment, but there's some sadness there about what he's given up. When we left North Carolina for Atlanta for that first critic job, he had just been offered his first head chef role, which he had to give up. When we left Atlanta for LA, he gave up a job that he really liked there. And adjusting to Australian life, you know, he really had to start from the beginning again because the industry is really different here.
You've worked in restaurants, Besha. You've eaten in restaurants all around the world. What do you think is the true soul of hospitality?
Honestly, the people who do it and care about it. I'm one of those people who just thinks everybody should have to do it, honestly, for a few months to understand it. You know, the word hospitality encompasses all of it. We use it so much that I think we forget its meaning. But that act of looking after somebody, of having them come into your space and feel at ease and taking care of them. I mean, that's what I missed during COVID so much, right? Is not the fanciness or the whatever. It's that you walk in and you just let go of the idea of cooking or cleaning or any of that stuff, and you let somebody take care of you that way. And there are very few things in life that you get to do that. It's almost this childlike thing of going back to just saying somebody's just going to take care of it, you know, which is part of why it's so upsetting when it goes wrong, because you are in a slightly vulnerable place if you are approaching it correctly, I think. I'll always miss that aspect of working in hospitality, that reading a table and saying, what do these people need right now? Do they need me to be entertaining? Do they need me to look after them? Do they need me to step back and let them have their space and kind of be invisible? There's something really profound in that that goes beyond commerce to me, that that I think is just really special and very human.
And you're no longer reviewing anonymously?
No.
What's it like just being yourself now?
Honestly, I hate it. There are upsides to it. I've always been in hiding the rest of my life. I can go to a party and introduce myself to people. So just being able to be more relaxed in my life has been nice. The work part of it has, you know, as much as it's really lovely to meet the people that I'm writing about sometimes and to have them be able to thank me in person or to, you know, be grumpy with me in person, as is the case, is nice. But that moment where I walk into a restaurant and it's clocked that that's who I am, and there's that kind of record scratch moment and everybody seizes up, I hate that in the core of my soul. In part because of what I was just talking about. You go to a restaurant because you want to let go, you want to relax, you want people to just be able to take care of you, and that is always best when they're relaxed too. It's very rare for people to be relaxed while serving me these days, and I miss that so, so much.
Besha, thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest today was Besha Rodel, chief restaurant critic for The Age and author of the memoir Hunger Like a Thirst. Today's episode was recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nation. It was produced by Alice Moldovan. Nicola Harrison is the executive producer. I'm Beverly Wang. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.